For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so this book is a letter that the Apostle Paul wrote to Timothy. And what Paul's trying to do in each one of these chapters is advise Timothy on how to restore the church that he leads back to health. And we've covered a lot of topics, but the one that we're going to focus on this entire time is the importance of good leadership. Yeah, good leaders. I think everyone would kind of intuitively agree that if you want to have a healthy church, that it has to have healthy leaders. There is a relationship between the health of our leaders and the health of the church. And that's really kind of a challenge in this day and age, because it just seems like almost every week you hear about this or that Christian leader who's been disqualified by something that they've done. I was curious, like within the last 2 weeks, what's happened? And so you've got, this is CBS News, scandal-tainted pastor banned from church. All Chilean bishops, all of them, offering to resign over a sex abuse scandal. You've got a pastor accused of theft, fired. And I could give you probably half a dozen more, which is really sad. And it really raises the question, you know, how should we be thinking about this whole area? And so I want to do that. I want to ask and answer some questions about leadership using 1 Timothy 3 as our base text. One question is, I think it's kind of an obvious question. If we've had all these problems with leaders in the past, why do we even need them? Maybe we could just have church and skip the leader part. Save ourselves a headache. What about this? If we have to have leaders and we keep seeing them go south, what can we do to get better at identifying good ones? That's something Paul spends a lot of time talking about. And here's another thing, just in case you're tempted to tune out because you have no interest in ever leading. Why is Paul so positive about people aspiring to lead? Why does he encourage that? Okay, so we're going to get into each of these three things as they come up. Let's start out with this first one. Why do we even need them? Do we even need leaders? When Paul starts out this chapter, he starts right away by mentioning leaders. He says it's a trustworthy statement. If anyone aspires to the office of overseer, it's a fine work that he desires to do. Okay, so he mentions this leadership role, the office of overseer. And if you look over in Titus, this is another letter that Paul wrote. He's clearly using the term overseer and elder interchangeably to refer to the same leadership position. Overseer really describes what a leader does. Elder kind of describes who they are. They're overseers in the sense that it's their responsibility to look over the flock, to look over the congregation of Christians that are under their care, to love them, right? And then the elder thing, it's not chronologically old. It's somebody who's more spiritually mature than the people they're leading. And so, again, these two terms refer to this single position that basically describes a mature Christian who oversees the entire church. And so he's clearly saying this is a thing that the church has this leadership role. Now, when you look at this, office of overseer, that sounds like somewhere you'd be sent if you got in trouble, you know? And overseeing, right? As soon as we call somebody an overseer, that's what they're going to do. They're going to oversee people and start to boss them around. There's a lot of things about this that are a little bit unnerving. When I was little, I really wanted to be an overseer. We had these crosswalk guards. And I saw that, and I saw how they could boss the little kids around. And I was like, I want that job. But apparently, I don't know, my teachers saw something in me that wasn't good. It's still painful to admit today I never got that job. They probably thought if they gave me too much power too soon, I'd be a sociopath or something. Anyhow, I mean, that's what we think of with oversight. We've probably all had some negative experiences with people that would view themselves this way. This is such a concern in some churches that some churches have basically just said, we don't want anything to do with leadership. This is one guy writing, I'd call him a leader, but his group doesn't believe in leaders. So he's a spokesman, I guess. He says, what we prefer to do is to gather under the headship of Jesus without a clergy. How about Jesus as our leader? Let's just stop at that. Where the members know one another deeply and they're experiencing a depth in Christ, where decisions are made by the community and where every member functions in the meetings or services without any man controlling, directing, facilitating, or dominating. And so, yeah, what about that vision of the church? You know, I could see how you might be more freed up to express your spirituality the way you wanted to. Or there might be, some protection from the abuses that we've seen leaders, you know, get involved in. But I don't know. I don't know if you've been in a leaderless environment. It's not necessarily utopia by any stretch. Leaderless groups can be demoralizing. You ever been in a really bad group project at school? You know, where everybody's pulling in different directions, there's a lot of energy being spent, and nothing's getting done. It's demoralizing. So, yeah, I don't know. I've been in situations where there wasn't a leader and it was a drag. Here's another problem with this perspective. The Bible affirms leadership. I mean, if 1 Timothy 3 means anything, it means that God is 110% behind the church having leaders, like he is in all these other passages in the Bible that talk about the legitimate role of leaders. So are we just going to dispense with this whole category because it's difficult? And here's something else I think that's really true you have to think about, is if you've ever been around a good leader, a great leader, is life-giving. You know, when leaders lead well, people really flourish under their leadership. You guys know who this is here? Anybody? Who said that? Yes. Nice job, Charlie. That is George Marshall. Now, a lot of us, when we think about generals in World War II, we think about Patton, Eisenhower, you know, MacArthur, guys like that. This is George Marshall. He, if you look closely, he has 5 stars on his shoulders. He is the general of the army. He's the general of the generals. And he was a powerful leader in World War II. Winston Churchill admitted, you know, the British and the Americans squabbled a lot, but he admitted Marshall was the organizer of victory. And a lot of people have never heard of this guy because he was humble and self-effacing. He put a lot of his effort into making sure the right people were in the right roles. And I'll tell you what, if this guy wasn't in charge during World War II, things could have been very different. A lot of us here, myself included, have had our lives profoundly changed by being in close proximity to a great leader. And are we just going to throw that all away because there's some bad apples out there? I think we got to be really careful. You know, you think about the problem. There are these bad leaders out there. It is a problem. But the solution isn't no leaders. It's good leaders. That's what we have to hold out for. And not only is it good leaders, but we got to remember, let's say we're in a so-called leaderless environment. You know, the truth is, in a leaderless environment, opinion leaders naturally emerge. That's just the way it's going to be. The question isn't, are we going to have leaders or not? We will have them. The question is, are they going to be good? And that's what this whole chapter is meant to address. Now, one more thing before we get into the nuts and bolts of identifying a good leader. This is something that we should think about. This should be like a shadow that's cast over everything I say all the way through this teaching. What is the nature of Christian leadership? We think of leaders, we think of people that seize control, that have their way. That's not how Jesus saw it. When he talked to his disciples about leadership, He told them, you know that the rulers in this world, they lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you, it'll be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve others and give his life as a ransom for many. But what do Christian leaders do? You know, Jesus was a king. He's called the King of Kings. But he wasn't like a normal king. He didn't like force people to fight his wars and amass people to enrich his wealth. It says right there, he didn't come to be served. He came to serve, to lay his life down as a ransom. That's the kind of leadership Jesus provides. You know, Jesus looks at you and me, looks at all of humanity, and sees that we're in desperate straits. We are culpable morally before God for violating his law, worthy of punishment. And instead of making us pay like we ought to pay for our crimes, Jesus was willing to pay the price himself. He doesn't want something from you. He gave his life for you so that you could be forgiven. That's what, when it says he gave his life as a ransom, when he went to the cross, he was being punished in our place, paying the price for our sins to set us free from judgment. If you're here and you don't know Christ, Jesus can be your leader, and this is the first thing he wants to do, is to serve you by paying this penalty for you. And you can experience his leadership by simply acknowledging, yes, I've been far from you, and calling out to him and asking for him to forgive you based on what he did on the cross. That's the kind of leadership he provides. And so as we're thinking about leaders, all the way through, you should have this image here that he's the example. What do leaders do? Leaders spend themselves. They lay their lives down for the benefit of the people that they lead, just like Jesus did. Okay. Now, where do you find somebody like that? They are rare. And we need some kind of criteria or way of sorting out, Is this the real deal? Is this the kind of leader that we should recognize in the church? And so that's what we get into when we dive into chapter 3. There's a lot here. I was kind of going back and forth about how to do this. I think I'm just going to read a big chunk of it and then break it down. Okay, so this whole section, this screen and the next screen, is what to look for when you're trying to identify a leader. He says, an overseer must be above reproach, a husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if someone doesn't know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? That's a good question. And not a new convert, so that he won't become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. And this potential leader must have a good reputation with those outside the church so that he won't fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Deacons likewise must be men of dignity, not double-tongued or addicted to much wine or fond of sordid gain, but holding to the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. These men must also first be tested. Let them serve as deacons if they're beyond reproach. Women must likewise be dignified, not malicious gossips, but temperate, faithful in all things. Deacons must be husbands of only one wife, that would be good, and good managers of their children and their own households. Okay, a ton of stuff in here. The first thing I want to point out is there's another leadership office. He calls them deacons. Now that is the Greek word deacon, and it literally means to serve. The fact that he's singling these individuals out as the special leadership role in the church means they're likely exemplary servants. And the only other thing that we know about these guys, we don't know a lot about deacons. We just know that they always come second after elders being mentioned, that they do some service, some teaching, But they're basically just under the direction of the elders. Some people use the term under shepherd, where they're on behalf of the oversight of the church, getting under them and ministering to people in the church. So that's what he's describing. Now, real quick, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. In verse 11, he mentions women. In this whole discussion of people serving in different leaderships, he mentions women. And some interpreters have said, well, he's clearly talking about the wives of deacons. That's who these people have to be. They're not leaders, they're just the wives of deacons. But I think that view is incorrect, and a couple quick reasons why. First of all, why, if they're just wives, does he have a whole list of qualifications like he does for the other leaders? And why, like we saw last week, are women like Phoebe singled out and named as deacons, as a deaconess in her case? And why are the male deacons introduced with the very same formula as the females are introduced with? This is clearly not just wives. These are female deacons. This is yet more evidence that we have women in leadership roles in the church. So I just wanted to put that out there one more time. Now, let's get into, for today, let's focus on how we identify good leaders. Let's break this up into three areas. You guys, this is Rey from Star Wars right here. This is what we typically think of with a leader, somebody who's strong, decisive, you know, who can take charge in a crisis, or you think about somebody like this, William Wallace. You know, this charismatic, you know, a man's man, a leader of men. But none of that is what you'll see emphasized in this passage. The thing that we're supposed to look for is character. I mean, it's so, in all the passages where the Bible talks about leadership, the message is really clear. Looking for a leader, pay attention to their character. And when he talks about character, he talks about this in negative and in positive terms. Negatively, these would be things that would disqualify a leader. If they're addicted to wine, getting drunk, or maybe abusing substances, that's a bad leader candidate right there. Somebody who's pugnacious. I like that word, just, you know, a pugilist, scrapper, a fighter. Somebody who's combative. Not a good leader candidate. Somebody who's double-tongued, who lies, who just doesn't tell the truth. All of these things are what Paul has in mind when he says leaders should be above reproach. It doesn't mean they need to be perfect. They need to be free of these disqualifying sins. On the positive side, a lot of things. He has quite a list. I'm just going to give you a few. They need to be faithful to their spouse. He describes them as being a one-woman man, somebody who's only sexually active with their spouse, someone who's temperate. And this means that this is somebody that's alert, who's not, you know, in a stupor, but who's aware of what's happening in the lives of the people that they lead and who's on top of things and engaged with them. He mentions being prudent. This is not like bouncing around and lunging like a pinball, just, you know, reacting to things, but being wise. And it literally means to be sane, to be a good decision maker, someone who's hospitable, a stranger lover. That's what it literally means. Somebody who makes people in a setting like this that are new feel right at home. Someone who's got a good reputation with those outside the church. You get the sense, it's not just the absence of the negative qualities, but it's the presence of these positive characteristics that need to be there for us to identify somebody as a leader. Now, why is all this important? Well, I mean, just think about what leaders do. Your job as a leader is to help people mature, to help them become Christ-like. You can't do that if you're not letting God do that in your own life. This is such a central part of leadership. Actually, in the very next chapter, Paul tells Timothy, one of the most important things you could do to lead is to just grow. Grow in a visible way that people can see. Timothy, pay attention to your own growth, because as you're growing, you'll lead others to do the same. So absolutely crucial. non-negotiable, have to have a solid character to be recognized as a leader. Leaders also need to understand and communicate God's truth. To elders and overseers, he tells them that they have to be able to teach. And I don't think he's talking about needing to teach in a big room setting like this. I think it's just the concept, can you take what you understand out of the Bible and make it make sense to somebody else? The other thing he gives us is a little more detail out of Titus, is that they should be able to hold fast these elders. They should be able to hold fast the faithful word, which is in accordance with the teaching, so that they can both exhort in sound doctrine and refute those who contradict. So it's not enough for an overseer to know their Bible. They also have to identify error and move in and correct people in love and just help them see what the Bible really teaches. With deacons, he mentions they should be able to hold to the mystery of the faith. Now, that's kind of a weird way to put it. The mystery of the faith is God's plan to reconcile human beings back to himself. It's a plan that focuses on Jesus, and it's a plan laid out in the entire Bible. And so he's saying a deacon needs to be familiar with that, and they need to have a clear conscience. They need to be the kind of people that are actually acting on what they've learned. So, yeah. A fair amount of Bible knowledge. That's something to look for in a leader. Why is this important? I think it's in verse 15, but toward the end of this chapter, Paul says the church should be the pillar and support of the truth. That the church should uphold what God says is true. Of course, if you look in history, it's filled with churches losing it all over the place, drifting away from what the Bible teaches. It's a super common. We see it all the time. How does that occur? Well, as the leader goes, or leaders go, so goes the church. If a leader is not fully equipped and trained in God's word, in the Bible, what's going to happen with the people they're leading? So it's, again, this is a non-negotiable essential thing to look for. And then lastly, I'd say the third broad emphasis in this chapter is they need to have a proven ministry track record. So he tells deacons, he says they should be tested first. He's saying we want to see some faithful service, faithful ministry in smaller areas. Have they followed through on the responsibilities that they've had? Have they been tested? He tells both deacons and elders that they need to manage their household well. That things at home, that they need to be leading at home well. And if you look in the next verse, in verse 5, He asks a very important question. He says, if these guys aren't leading well at home, if they're not managing their affairs at home well, how will they manage the affairs in the church? That's a very good question. And it gets to a principle here when we're thinking about who should lead. We should be looking for people that are demonstrating faithfulness, serving in a smaller setting, before leading in a larger setting. That's why, for instance, in our church, we do have elders that are responsible for overseeing our whole entire church. But what we'd like to see before someone becomes an elder is that they're doing a good job leading a home church. And what we'd like to see before somebody leads a home church is that they're doing a good job loving the people that God has put in their lives. Jesus put this whole principle another way. He said, if you're faithful in a little thing, you're faithful in much. Okay, so this is another component to think about it. Why is this crucial? It's crucial because leaders influence a lot of people. And it's a huge responsibility to be an overseer of a church like this. And that's why it's important. We want to see demonstrated faithfulness in a smaller setting, because a lot of people's lives will be impacted if we put the wrong person in a leadership role. All right, now, so that's the whirlwind tour. Let's think about it a different way. So you've got a stool, right? Each leg is essential. There's no way this stool can do its job if one of these legs doesn't work. Each of these components of leadership is essential. We can't have two out of three. If we want a good leader, if they're a dynamite teacher and they've done some great ministry, but their character is questionable, That's a mistake. All three of these things need to be there. Now, let me say two more things about this whole issue of what to look for based on this before we move on. One is it's not that we're looking for perfection. You know, there are situations where leaders can do something disqualifying, like sleeping with someone other than their spouse or stealing or embezzling. And that's time when it's time to step out of leadership. But a lot of times leaders fail in these areas in different ways. There are no perfect leaders. And if you're in a leadership role and you've blown it in one of these areas, that doesn't necessarily mean you need to quit. Most of the time, we just need to come clean, talk to somebody, get help, go back to the cross and what Christ did for us, dust ourselves off, and keep on moving. There's not a leader in this fellowship who hasn't blown it in some of these areas at times. So we're not talking about perfection. And I also really want to be clear that this is not just for leaders. Just look at these descriptions. You know, being changed to become like Christ, character transformation, learning more Bible over time, learning to serve and love people. What is that? That's a picture of Christian maturity. This is what God wants for every single person in this room. He wants to see us, with his help, advancing in each of these areas. And I'll tell you, if you do, if you decide to cooperate with God and let him change you and purpose to get in there and learn the Bible and love the people God's put in front of you, someday somebody may come up to you and say, hey, would you be willing to lead? And when they do, they're not going to be appointing you as a leader. They're going to be recognizing the leadership that you've already been providing. There's no magic formula. We don't appoint leaders. We just look around and recognize who's advancing in these areas and give them a more visible role. That's how it works. All right. This last part, let's think about this. Why is it okay to aspire to lead? Why does he encourage that? He says right here, this is a trustworthy statement, so we're going all the way to the beginning again. It's a trustworthy statement, and this has the flavor of, like, you can take this to the bank. If there are people in the church that aspire to the office of overseer, it's a fine work that they desire to do. It's a good thing when you're in an environment in the church where people are aspiring to lead. You may look at that and go, well, that just seems weird because it just seems intrinsically self-promoting, you know, to aspire to lead. How can that be a good thing? Well, this is where we got to go back to the nature of leadership, Christian leadership. It's aspiring not to serve yourself, but to lay your life down for people that you're caring for. And if that's what you're aspiring to do, Paul is all for it. That's awesome. That's the kind of thing we need more of. And we need more of it, too, because as time goes on, the church needs leaders. You think about things that happen in the church, sometimes existing leaders, they just can't continue. Maybe aging or something like that. They're just not able to continue pursuing leadership, illness. We have leaders that do get disqualified. And when these things happen, those leaders have to be replaced. Somebody has to step up. You know, the other thing we'll see, and we've seen it here, I think this church started out with about 40 people. Now there's 6,000. We have more leaders than we used to have because we have more people to love than we used to have. And so as God blesses our church, and I think he will bless our church with growth, we're going to need more people to care for those folks. And so, yeah, if you aspire to lead, if you feel like God's calling you to step up and love people that he's put under your care, that's a good thing. In fact, that ought to be a common aspiration. And it would be a mark of health in a church where you have a lot of people aspiring to do this for the right reasons. Of course, the flip side is also true. What if you're hearing this all the time? That's really great you're willing to lead, but it's not for me. I'm really grateful you're doing what you're doing, but don't ever ask me to step up and lead for God. I don't want to be too controversial, But I'm just trying to think, like, as a body, especially, you know, us adults here, what's our tendency? Are we, like, too frequently, unrighteously clamoring to be a leader? Or is this tend to be the way we view leadership? That's great, but boy, I just hope I never have to do that. I think this thing is what we struggle with. And if this becomes the prevailing way we view leadership, we're in trouble. Because God's church needs good leaders and will continue to need good leaders. And so I'd like to spend a little bit of time just thinking about, okay, why would somebody kind of check the box, no thank you, I don't want to lead? And let me just say before I go through some of these, they're not all bad. Some of them, they're reasons why somebody would say I can't lead right now. The first thing I would throw out there is that maybe other legitimate responsibilities in your life make leading impossible. This is J. Robertson McQuilkin, and that's his wife, Muriel. McQuilkin was the president of Columbia International University. Dynamic teacher, powerful leader. And when his wife got Alzheimer's, he told the faculty and staff at his university, he was like, I can't lead anymore. I'm going to take care of my wife. And I wanted to show this clip of, this is actually an audio clip of the speech he gave to his faculty and students when he stepped out of his leadership role. So let's do that.
I haven't in my life experienced easy decision making on major decisions, but one of the simplest and clearest decisions I've had to make is this one, because circumstances dictated it. Muriel, now, in the last couple of months, seems to be almost happy when with me, and almost never happy when not with me. In fact, she seems to feel trapped, becomes very fearful, sometimes almost terror, and when she can't get to me, there can be anger, she's in distress. But when I'm with her, she's happy and contented. And so I must be with her at all times. And you see, it's not only that I promised in sickness and in health, till death do us part, and I'm a man of my word. But as I have said, I don't know with this group, but I've said publicly, it's the only fair thing. She sacrificed for me for 4 years to make my life possible. So, if I cared for her for 40 years, I'd still be in debt. However, there's much more. It's not that I have to, it's that I get to. I love her very dearly, and you can tell it's not easy to talk about. She's a delight. It's a great honor to care for such a wonderful person.
All right. I tried to find a version without the music. Yeah, it's a powerful story. You know, he left all of it. He left his leadership role. He was a sought-after conference speaker, and he left it all to be with his wife. And when he did, I think he was exactly where he needed to be. And I get a little emotional about this because I got a relative who's going through that stretch of life. But anyhow, I'm just saying there's going to be some people here who are leading now and who won't be able to lead because they'll have some responsibilities like this. And when they leave to go take care of whatever it is, they need our love and support and esteem. That's important. So there's that. What about this? Maybe you see leading as something you do alone. This is another thing that a lot of times people, when they look forward to the day when they might lead, they envision just kind of being out there slogging it away all by themselves. We don't lead that way in this church. We believe in leading in teams. It's modeled in the New Testament. People led in teams. And we believe in that because inevitably, life being what it is, things are going to happen in the life of a leader where, you know, adversity or a trial knocks us off balance, and we can't and should not function at the same level that we normally function as a leader. You know, in 2013, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer, which obviously changed everything for us. And we didn't step out of leadership, but we did obviously stop leading at the same level that we were leading. And part of what made that possible was we have our co-leaders, Jay and Patty Young, who we're very dear friends with. And we went through that passage of our lives together. You know, we benefited from their love and support. They picked up a lot of slack. And after, I don't know, 18 months or so, when the clouds started to part and Edith was, and she's doing fantastic now, but as we came out of that part of our lives, we were able to start ramping back up and stepping back into our leadership role. But what made it possible was the depth of our friendship with our co-leaders. That gave us the resilience to hang in there. And I'm telling you, if you're leading a home church in our fellowship here and you don't have that, you've got to fight for it. There's maybe nothing more important that you could do as a leader than strengthen your friendships with your co-leaders on your team, because it's important to do it together. I get it, too. If you feel like a leadership is this rigid and flexible thing, something you have to do all by yourself, I wouldn't want to lead either. But it's not meant to be that way. Maybe you're cynical about leadership because you know bad leaders. I said at the beginning of the talk, you know, every week there's another leader who's going down for one reason or another. You know, you see that in our culture. That's led to this kind of widespread cynicism about leadership. And if that cynicism comes into the church and we quit being zealous to see a high character leader doing great things for God, if we give up on that, we're screwed, because God wants to lead his church through leaders, human leaders that he's raised up. And so it's really crucial that we believe in what God says about leadership, that we believe that God can do great things through leaders that are surrendered to him, and that we're willing, if called upon, if we sense that God is moving us in that direction, to believe that he could even use us to do that. So yeah, I think that would be toxic to the church if we let cultural cynicism about leadership bleed into everything that we do here. We got to reject that. What about this? Maybe you're unwilling to lead because of a past negative experience in a leadership role. Anybody who's led for any amount of time will tell you that they've had a few negative experiences. Let me give you just a couple I've run into. Being ignored. I don't know if I've told you guys this story before, but after leading home churches in this fellowship for 13 years, I applied for a position up at our church. Turned in my resume. Didn't hear anything. Still pissed about it. I just can't believe I've been blood, sweat, and tears trying to love the people in my group. I take a shot at getting a job and nothing. Just feeling, you know, totally undervalued. You've got your co-leader makes a huge decision that affects the whole group and doesn't even talk to you about it. Or you've got being undermined. You've got people that you're trying to lead actively opposing what you're trying to do. Or being misrepresented or misquoted. I hate that. I didn't say that. And this person's saying, I said that. That's brutal. Or you got things like you've invested in somebody and they just decided, I quit. I don't want to follow God anymore. Can I have like 20 more minutes? I got tons of stories about stuff like that. I could just go on and on about, yeah. There's no doubt. How should we? This is a reality. It would be wrong to deny, yes, there will be negative experiences associated with leading. So what do we do with that? Well, Jesus tried to manage our expectations, right? He said, in the world you have tribulation. As long as you're in the world serving me, it's going to be this way. And then he says, take courage. I've overcome the world. So, yeah, leadership is a great endeavor. And in every great endeavor you ever pursue, you'll be stung at times by failure, by setbacks and whatnot. What's beneficial for us is because we know God, he can take some of those kicks in the mouth and actually use those to transform our character and help us become the kind of leader that he wants us to be. So he can redeem that stuff. But yeah, no doubt, there will be negative experiences. There's no way to get around that. And then what about this? Maybe you're too preoccupied with other aspirations. Is it possible that we're so passionate about other pursuits that when God comes knocking and says, I have something for you to do, we view that as an unwanted interruption because we've got this other thing that we want to take care of? This is a video game called The Crew. It's a race, first-person race game. And I was online trying to find an example of this, but this game, like a lot of games, awards achievements for completing missions. And they get unlocked, and the video game player gets these achievements. Well, this one guy who loves this game was upset at the software company because the achievements weren't working. And so here's him pouting about it. He's like, I went through and I redid all 65 missions again with platinum medals. And the extra mile achievement still won't unlock. Considering that I've finished all 65 missions with platinum medals, 3 times each already, 195 missions, I think it's pretty clear that my life has no purpose. Now, what's it say? I think it's pretty clear the just redo a few of the missions method isn't going to work for me. It's like some pathetic life principle. I don't know. But he's like, this situation, it stinks. I have all the other achievements for this game and a 900 out of 1,000 gamer score, but I'm missing the final 100 points because the extra mile achievement is broken for me. And then he adds, wah. And he's like, say, eh. All right. I'm just going to guess, if this is the kind of thing that fuels your passion, you're not going to be aspiring to lead in God's church anytime soon, right? This is something that, it's a thing, but it's displaced this main thing of loving and serving God's people. That should be the main thing in all of our lives. And so whether it's this, or making more money than we really need to make, or, you know, advancing our career at all costs, we'll go anywhere, do anything to advance our career. Doesn't matter how it affects our spiritual life. Overscheduling our kids. I've almost offended everybody in the room. Here's my thing. What's that?
Keep going.
12 hours of college football on Saturday. That would be my thing. Whatever it is. What's that?
EPL, not college football.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. College football is the best. These things, that thing, they aren't bad things necessarily, but when they supplant serving and loving others as the main thing, and God comes and says, how about it? Will you step up for me and care for my people? Our answer is going to be no. And what we have to do is just admit, Lord, it's kind of like what Nee says. Watch what Nee calls these things, the thing in hand. And we have to look at that thing that we have, and we've got to go, you know, I value this above all else. I value it above you. I recognize that. I know that's wrong. You made me. You give life meaning. And I may still do this once in a while, but I'm going to put you back in your proper place. You're my main thing, and representing your interest is what I want to focus on. And I think it's important to do that because God is going to come to some of us and say, how about it? How about caring for my people? And when he does, you'll be able to say yes because you've had this transaction with God. This is really important. All right, the last verse. He says, those who have served well as deacons obtain for themselves a high standing and a great confidence in the faith that's in Christ. I love the way he ends this because when we think about leading, we often think about what we're going to lose. That is the way we're kind of zero-sum thinkers. We think, I'm going to lose time. I'm going to probably lose face if it doesn't go well. I'm going to lose control because I'm going into an unscripted environment with a very difficult task that's beyond my ability. We really think about our fears associated with doing these kinds of things. And that's fine. There are costs. And it's important to be aware of the costs. But you should also think about the other side of the ledger and think about the benefits. You know, he says, you serve well as a deacon and you'll attain for yourself a high standing. He's not saying you'll earn salvation. He's saying in God's eyes, you'll have high standing. When you're with God at the end of history and he's surveying the way you've lived, he'll say, well done. Well done. Thank you for caring for my people that I put under your charge. And I cannot think of anything that's more worth my time and energy and devotion than pleasing the God that made me. And that's one thing you can look forward to if you're willing to care for the people God's entrusted to you. The other thing he says is you have great confidence in the faith. And this is more of an experiential thing. He's saying that as you step out and lead, you will see God deliver, that he'll step forward with the resources you need, and that will boost your faith. If some of you have led, if you've led at all, you know just the profound sense of inadequacy that leaders can feel. You're just like, what am I doing here? I am just so unqualified, so incapable, so wrong for this role. You know, I think any leader that's led for a while has gone through stretches like that. But when you, in faith, knowing that God's got your back, go ahead and serve people anyhow, you experience him coming through. This happened to me about 10 years ago. I started a high school Bible study for low-income kids. I was way older than they were. I was from a different part of town than they were. And I was understaffed. It was a very small team of us that were trying to do this. And I'll tell you what. God took that little bit of effort and that little bit of capability and just exploded things, reached so many different high school kids. And I will always, I was changed by that experience because I saw when you take a small step of faith, God will resource you to do what he calls you to do. And that's a treasure, man. That's great. That'll give you great confidence in the faith. So if with, you know, fear and trembling, fully aware of your weaknesses, you sense God pressing on you, will you lead for me? Don't talk yourself off the cliff. And don't ask God to get somebody else to do it. Tell God, tell him, I know this isn't an easy work, but you say it's a fine work. And you promise you'll be with me every way. And I'll do it. I think that's what he wants. So, okay. Here you go. 1 Timothy 3.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.